find links to all of this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. In George's voice, I hear echoes of the fantastic 1971 Firesign Theater audio play called I Think We're All Bozos on This Bus. As George's mentally enslaved consumers gawk at a faux futuristic theme park that is life. That Firesign Theater album is available on YouTube, or find a link in my show blog published Wednesdays, late Pacific time. Even more, though, George's writing reminds me of Guy Debord in his 1967 book, The Society of the Spectacle. After New Science on Methane Escapes Under the Sea with Professor Davies, you will hear my 10-minute introduction to Guy Debord.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Huge amounts of the super warming gas methane lie frozen at the bottom of the sea. They are called clathrates. If they thaw and escape, a hothouse world surely results. New Science finds even methane buried deep in the seabed can get out. The paper, published October 2023 in Nature Geoscience, is titled Long Distance Migration and Venting of Methane from the Base of the Hydrate Stability Zone. From Newcastle University, we are joined by the Pro Vice Chancellor, Global and Sustainability, and lead author of the study, Dr. Richard Davies. Richard Davies, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
We are going to talk about warming gases below the seabed, 1,000 or more feet below the surface. Humans never see that. We wouldn't know it was there. How did your team discover this methane?
We've known about the methane for decades. It's been detected from the 1970s onwards when seismic reflection data, when you send a sound wave into the Earth, the sound wave gets bounced back off the base of the methane because it's a boundary where there is a change in density and velocity and the sound waves bounce back. So you can detect them. You can detect this this hydrate reservoir around the world. But what I did during 2020, during lockdown, I'd had a number of PhD students studying this seismic data offshore Mauritania, but in 2020, after a decade of looking at the data, I dusted it off and started looking at it again because we were in lockdown in the United Kingdom, and I made this remarkable discovery of these giant pot marks, big craters on the seabed, or just underneath the seabed, which were evidence of methane escape. So the basic technique is to look at seismic data, we call it. It's three-dimensional. It's a huge data set offshore of Mauritania, and it provides a layer-by-layer sort of picture of what's going on offshore Mauritania, where these hydrate reservoirs are located. And what we have evidence for is that they're melting when you warm the ocean.
It is wild and ironic that a drive by fossil fuel companies to find more warming gases paid the very high costs of mapping what lies below the sea. And you even found strange little volcano shapes, as you mentioned, hidden in the layers of the seabed. Do we know what caused them?
Yes, I totally agree. I mean, the oil and gas industry acquires this data at vast cost, and then it's academics and students who get to pore over it and to use it to understand the Earth and understand processes. And so it can be put to good use. The giant craters, we've seen giant craters on the seabed before. The ones that we discovered, or I discovered in 2020, are about a kilometre wide, about 50 metres deep. And we've seen these before, and they form usually due to methane bubbling up to the seabed. And as it hits the seabed, the methane just pulls up and trains some of the soft sediment into the water column, and just slowly, bit by bit, bubble by bubble, erodes a crater. Now, if the crater is a kilometre wide and 50 metres deep, it suggests that a lot of gas has escaped from this particular region offshore of Mauritania. And so these pot marks, as we call them, are very distinctive things that we've seen on seismic data for the last 20 years. And when I saw them, I knew pretty quickly, yes, instinctively, that this was evidence of a significant as I called it, massive venting of gas, probably methane, because, of course, what I also knew is just in the deeper water, a few tens of kilometres away, was a very significant hydrate reservoir which was susceptible to melting when the climate warmed. And the climate has warmed over the last 20,000 years.
Are these pockmarks, as you say, currently venting methane, or is this something that happened in the long past?
One or two of them are still at the seabed. So when you look at the images, you can see on the seismic reflection data that some are buried by up to 80 meters of sediment. And one or two are at the seabed. That doesn't mean they're active now, but it suggests they may be. The only way of telling exactly when these features formed is to go to drill them. And sometimes in the bases of these craters, you find carbonate concretions, basically carbonate growths, and those carbonates have grown there because of the venting methane, and you can date the growths, therefore date the methane. So we don't know exactly when they formed, but because they're only buried by 80 meters of sediment, they formed probably in the last 1 million years, some of them possibly active right now.
What are the estimates for the amount of methane buried under the sea, and how does that compare to greenhouse gases in the atmosphere now?
Okay, well, I haven't looked at the amount of greenhouse gas, methane greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, but I can tell you that the estimates for the amount that's trapped in, of carbon trapped in methane hydrates has varied significantly over the years. And overall, over the last 10 or 15 years, perhaps 20 years actually, the estimates have gone down. So they started as very large estimates. It's now estimated about 1,800 gigatons of carbon are trapped in in methane hydrates, whereas oil and gas is about 5,000 gigatons. So it's smaller than oil and gas underground, but it's still a very, very big source of carbon. The difference between methane hydrates under the ocean and oil and gas is that we cannot control the leak of gas from methane hydrates. Of course, we can control what comes out of an oil well by not producing the oil.
There's been a lot of worry about methane bubbling up from the shallow seas north of Siberia in the Arctic. But frozen methane is found along many coastlines, and here you are working off the coast of Africa. So how widely distributed are these clathrates?
Well, they pretty much go around every continent of planet Earth. When you get, I mean, obviously varies depending on the water temperature, but generally speaking, between about 450 meters to 700 meters, there is a zone where the pressure and temperature are just suitable for methane hydrate to exist just below the seabed. And when it's just below the seabed, of course, any temperature changes at the seabed make this hydrate vulnerable. So there's a rim all pretty much around most continents.
So oceans are warming around the world. We know that. They're setting new records for at least as long as we've been able to measure them. Is that what is causing methane to escape from the seabed, or are there other factors possibly at play?
No, the dominant factor is increasing the temperature of the seabed, and this has been detected on the east coast of the United States, and it's also been detected around Spitsbergen in the Arctic Circle. In fact, the melting of hydrates in Spitsbergen, offshore from Spitsbergen, is thought to be related possibly to seasonal changes in temperature. Now, on the east coast of the United States, there's papers published in the last decade which have suggested that melting of hydrates is caused by a movement of the Gulf Stream. So the reason hydrates are melting in this very vulnerable zone between 450 and 700 meters is because of temperature change. What we're proposing, and this is why the research is novel and new, is we think people have been looking in the wrong place. We've actually shown that the methane can migrate from the deep ocean all the way up to near the shelf, going past this zone of 450 to 700 meters and bubbling up at shallower locations. It sort of bypasses that vulnerable zone, going right from the deep ocean to the shallow from 1 or 2 kilometers depth right up to 300 meters depth water depths, bypassing this vulnerable zone that most scientists have focused on for the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, this is alarming. How could methane travel so great distances underground?
Well, under the sea, as the sediments get laid down, as they come out of deltas and are distributed into the oceans, they can form quite uniform layers of sediment. And in those layers, some of the layers are sandy, and therefore they provide a natural permeability, which is the ability for fluids to move through a rock unit. It's effectively the natural plumbing that exists underneath every single continental margin around every single continent on planet Earth. Now, this particular region, the margin is very simple. It's not disrupted by any significant faults or folds, and therefore the original sedimentary layers are probably connected from the deep ocean to the shallow. One of the things so when you release the methane in the deep ocean, 200 meters below the seabed, for example, it can migrate upwards towards the shallower regions until it gets to this magical depth of around 300 meters, where it has enough buoyancy to erupt through into the ocean. So simple margins where the geology is not disrupted by faults and other things, the plumbing can create these long-distance migration routes, and that's what we found.
For the current battle to save the climate, the essential question is, can methane bubbling up from the dark ocean bottom reach the atmosphere where it would warm the planet, or will it be captured by ocean water and organisms that eat methane?
Yes, it's a very important question. There was some research published a few years ago which said that really, if the water's deeper than a 400 or 500 meters, the gas would have to come out at a very high rate in very significant, massive fluxes, because the gas would normally dissolve in the water column. So you need a significant chimney of gas to get from the seabed, let's say, at 600 meters below the sea surface, right up to the atmosphere. What's important about the research we've just published is that we've shown that the gas can migrate to shallower locations, bypassing this vulnerable zone where the hydrate's just below the seabed. And so these gas vents are actually 15 or so kilometers landward of any hydrate. And they're at shallower depths at 300 meters. And they're big vents. They're big pot marks. It does suggest that something significant happened there over the last million years, possibly over the last 18,000 years. So my view is that there will be places on Earth where this will happen. But it does take time for the temperature change in the ocean, caused by climate change, to penetrate down to 200 meters, where the hydrate is very susceptible in the deep ocean. And so a change we make today or 100 years ago would take some time to impact those hydrate reservoirs.
If a quantity of escaping methane stays in the ocean, does that add to ocean acidity?
Yes, it does. And that's so even if this methane doesn't hit the atmosphere, get to the atmosphere, because the plumes have to be very big because the methane dissolves in the water column, it would cause ocean acidity, increases in ocean acidity, so there's no doubt about that. You know, where we are as scientists, I don't think we really know yet how much is going to come from the different routes we've all established. There's many different papers on how this methane could get into the ocean and the atmosphere. What we don't really know is how much. The latest research on the east coast of America has shown that it could be melting right now, but it's really uncertain how much will get into the water column and how much would reach the atmosphere.
It sounds like all the carbon budgets and plans to decarbonize might need to speed up just to accommodate these large unknowns in a looming methane release. Is there any way to quantify that risk from methane class rates, and how does that add to the urgency to control human-made greenhouse gases?
I don't know. I haven't done any research on the exact carbon budgets. I've really just been focusing on, can I work out where it's come from under the ocean? And I think we've made some good progress on that. But yeah, this is a worry. I did read a research paper recently that said, despite the fact that on the east coast of the US, the Gulf Stream may have moved and started to melt methane hydrate, there is no additional methane that's being detected in the water column yet. So that's the last paper I read on it. But the exact budgets and how much is going to be flux coming into the atmosphere and the ocean and what that means for mankind, it's an area I just haven't researched. And I wish, you know, I had more hours in the day. In my role in Newcastle University as Vice President for Global. And so, you know, this was a startling discovery for me where I got to dust off something I haven't done for a long time. And it's been an amazing experience, but it sort of makes me realize that research is the most exciting thing that you can do, particularly when you're working on topics like this. But I wish I knew more about how much is coming out and what that might mean for COP28 and the discussions that are taking place around CO2 and other greenhouse gases such as methane. I don't know.
I wish we all knew more about that. So more than a decade ago, two Russian scientists alarmed the world, suggesting a 50 gigaton release of methane from the sea was possible at any time. They required a landslide undersea for that to happen. Expedition ships were sent to the Arctic to find out more, including one funded by the Swedish Academy. But little came of that, really. And methane levels in the atmosphere are going up, but recent science finds the increase is coming mainly from tropical bogs, as they heat up. Where do you place your new research in this mix?
Well, what I think our research has shown is that there are parts of the continental shelf which, if the geology is simple enough, these will be leak zones. These will contribute in the future. And I think what this has shown is that the hydrate reservoir, which is absolutely vast, 3.5% of it exists in this vulnerable zone, which is between 400 and 700 meters, 450 to 700 meters water depth. What we're showing is that 96.5% of the hydrate reservoir, which is located in deep water, could contribute. If the margins are simple and you start warming the ocean, that thermal effect will penetrate down to the base of the hydrate reservoir where hydrate is barely stable, and it will melt. And so what we're showing is this 96.5% of the 1,800 gigatons is accessible, and it is vulnerable. No one knew that before. Now, other research in how you could release large volumes of methane hydrate from, for example, slope failures can contribute. I've never seen anyone sort of say X is going to come from slope failures versus the mechanism that we've published just in the last few days. But all of these routes are possible. What we don't know is their relative importance yet. When I retire in a few years' time, I'm still working with some Chinese scientists on this. From the South China Sea, where they're drilling gas hydrates to see if they can produce them. Now, I'm not interested in that at all. But it actually, of course, again, accesses data and creates a data set that I can work on, because I'm very interested in how this methane is going to leak out when it starts to leak out.
From the University of Newcastle, we've been speaking with Dr. Richard Davies, and you can find links to the paper and his article in the conversation in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Richard, thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolute pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Right, I need some brave boys and girls who aren't afraid to live outside the law of gravity. Families who like to sleep in tubes and push buttons. Adventurers like you.
In view of the gravity of the situation, believing that radio has a responsibility to serve in the public interest at all times,
are you worried about crazy events? Do you think you're alone out there, perhaps the only sane one left?
The specialization of images of the world is completed in the world of the autonomous image, where the liar has lied to himself. the spectacle in general, as the concrete inversion of life, is the autonomous movement of the non-living. Guy Debord.
We know now planet Earth cannot support 8 billion humans, all consuming resources and creating the pollution that kills off other life and possibly our own future. No dictator or hero can intervene to save us, because those who benefit hold the ultimate weapons, the power of production, and the voice of media, and we play along with all of that.
The spectacle grasped in its totality is both the result and the project of the existing mode of production. It is not a supplement to the real world, an additional decoration. It is the heart of the unrealism of the real society. In all its specific forms, as information or propaganda, as advertisement or direct entertainment consumption, the spectacle is the present model of socially dominant life. It is the omnipresent affirmation of the choice already made in production and its corollary consumption. Guy Debord.
The crux of change is identified by Marxist theorists like the French philosopher Guy Debord. Our personal functions have been channeled to gather products which we use to build our unnatural identity. We are consumers. Some of us work to feed a specialized part to the machine, and that may be steel or video or user data. And are we feeling down or worried? New clothes or a new car will cheer us right up.
Consume, consume, consume until we have no planet left to consume. What you need to do is buy things that you don't need. That's the best way to support the economy.
Guy Debord was born in 1931 and passed away in 1994. He wrote philosophic works, he made movies, and founded activist groups, often based in his home of Paris. Today we glance quickly at Guy's inspirational work, The Society of the Spectacle, published in 1967. The Paris Revolts of 1968 quickly followed, and Debord was among those who occupied the Sorbonne University. What is The Spectacle? Here is an English translation from the film version of Society of the Spectacle.
In societies dominated by modern conditions of production, life is presented as an immense accumulation of spectacles. Everything that was directly lived has receded into a representation. The images detached from every aspect of life merge into a common stream in which the unity of that life can no longer be recovered. Fragmented views of reality regroup themselves into a new unity as a separate pseudo-world that can only be looked at. The specialization of images of the world evolves into a world of autonomized images where even the deceivers are deceived. The spectacle is a concrete inversion of life, an autonomous movement of the non-living. The spectacle presents itself simultaneously as society itself, as a part of society, and as a means of unification. As a part of society, it is the focal point of all vision and all consciousness. But due to the very fact that this sector is separate, it is in reality the domain of delusion and false consciousness. The unification it achieves is nothing but an official language of universal separation.
Debord was also a founder of an influential French art and culture criticism movement called the Situationists. Anyone contemplating activism should learn more about them. In the Wikipedia entry for Situationists International, we find, in Debord's terms, Situationists define the spectacle as an assemblage of social relations transmitted via the imagery of class power, and as a period of capitalist development wherein, quote, all that was once lived has moved into representation, end quote. When the Industrial Revolution took flight in the 1830s, it was easy to see people's lives were rapidly redefined, literally, to fit the needs of the machine. In the days before mass transportation, mill workers needed to live near the mill. They were moved, some forcibly, others by a desire for wages, from their homes in the countryside into row housing in a town which became a complex city. It was not just a physical move. The consciousness of the British lower class had to be trained to punctuality and detail in order to work with machines. Minds were reshaped to fit the needs of production. Later, Marxists developed that knowledge further. In a second stage, developing more in America in the 1930s, ideas from Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, and Frederick Winslow Taylor enabled mass production of merchandise. The public had to be educated as consumers, and that was the role of advertising. De Boer might argue consumers were needed to fulfill the capability of production. Drawing on De Boer, we might guess a key to reprogramming human desires and ideas about ourselves is the subject must never awake to a new state or revert to an old one. Either would break the chain of production and social power. A separate state of consciousness, complementary to the needs of production and tied to it, has been created. It would replace the former direct experience of a lived environment by our natural selves, and it replaces it with the spectacle. These are not just circuses or a blockbuster movie everybody talks about and daydreams about. It is not just the media or social media. There is no single image for the spectacle because it is a pattern of social behaviors allowing manufactured consciousness to replace the personhood innate to our species and possibly all species. Consider a modern human encountering a bear. The bear is not thinking about events on the other side of the planet and has never seen Seinfeld. The bear may have developed patterns of thought from parents or siblings, but we presume the bear is present to the immediate situation, which also contains a human, a strong stimulant. The human may at first be looking at an image in a phone, but looks up to see the bear and decides to record the encounter with the bear on the phone to post for friends later. Already, this is an extended event, possibly reaching thousands of others, stimulating their mental images and social responses for a bear. The human may not actually see the particular bear who is present, possibly with old wounds or distinctive ears. The human may be drawing on previously ingested images of bears, old news stories of killer bears, nursery rhymes of friendly childhood bears, all manner of things. De Boer asks, how present are we, really? The false consciousness of consumerism, noted by many Marxist writers, has to be built on replicas of reality, and they are never specifically true. In fact, the spectacle depends on our ability to lie to ourselves. This recognition of social falsehood helps explain the domination of denial in our world today.
In a world which really is topsy-turvy, the true is a moment of the false. Guy Debord, Society of the Spectacle, 1967.
With more reading, we better understand how a majority of humans try to pretend a global pandemic, violent threats to democracy, and climate breakdown are not happening. You can find various versions of Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle online. I will put links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. A bit of news, my full video course, Build a Geothermal Greenhouse in Your Backyard, is now available free for all Radio EcoShock listeners. I recorded the whole process from bare ground through construction. I tried for a very low-energy all-season greenhouse in Canada through bitter cold and record heat. Help yourself at ecoshock.org or search YouTube for EcoShock Greenhouse Playlist. Repeat, EcoShock Greenhouse Playlist on YouTube for your free course on personal geothermal growing. See if it's for you. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock this week, and thank you for caring about our world.
And finally,
William S. Burroughs.
Listen to my last words anywhere. Listen, all you boards, governments, syndicates, nations of the world, and you powers behind what filth deals consummated in what laboratory, to take what is not yours, to sell out your sons forever, to sell the ground from unborn feet forever. Listen to my last words, any world.
What now, Brian?
We should flee in terror. Yes, that would be the wisest course.